Hello there. Today is Thursday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is back from his first overseas trip as allies navigate the new U.S. leader.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to make history.
The president plans to announce his decision about whether to leave the Paris Climate Accord.
So far, Trump is doing everything Putin could have wanted.
A new word tweeted by the president has become a social media guessing game. Also, NASA announces a mission to touch the sun. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump is back to work at the White House following his first overseas trip and returning to no shortage of controversies. There are four congressional investigations of possible Trump campaign links to Russia and Moscow's meddling in the election. In addition, the Justice Department appointed former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Robert Mueller, as a special counsel to probe whether Trump campaign aides illegally colluded with Russia during the long political campaign. And following the G7 summit, it would seem many world leaders are now viewing the United States in a new light. Joining me now for some perspective is Jeremy Mayer, associate professor of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. So, do you think the world is seeing the U.S. in a different light?
I absolutely think the world is altering its view of the United States. Now, it's not all negative. It seems clear to me that Saudi Arabia and a number of the Gulf states are happier with President Trump than they were with President Obama. But America's traditional allies, Germany, France, the UK, these countries are looking at Trump and they don't recognize him as part of the legacy of post-World War II American leaders.
Why is that?
Because Trump scolded the NATO alliance, and he started his speech in Saudi Arabia saying, I'm not going to lecture to you. So he berated our friends and cozied up to nations who don't share our values in a way that prior presidents usually avoided doing.
Is it possible for a nation like ours to go it alone, to take the view that it's America first and everybody else you're on your own? Will that ultimately, in your view, help us or hurt us?
Well, isolationism has been present in American ideology since the founding and before. There were always people in this country who believed that we were a blessed nation and that we should stay aloof from the troubles of the world. And historically, there was a vast change in American foreign policy with World War II, when America accepted a global role in a way that it really never done before. And so is it possible that a nation like the United States could go it alone? There's no law against it. We certainly could strike a new, more isolationist tone. And it's an interesting form of isolationism because at the same time that he's threatening to rupture older alliances, he's also increasing the military budget, which is an odd combination.
Are you concerned at all?
I think this has been some of the scariest months in the recent decades of American foreign policy. It is remarkable also that so many people who study foreign policy and practice foreign policy are this concerned when we're actually not in a crisis. Usually we are concerned about international security and American security when there's a 9/11, when there's a Korean War. But right now, this is all self-inflicted wounds. No one is really pressing us to make these catastrophic errors. We are shooting ourselves in the foot and a lot of other body parts.
Adding to all of this is the president's coming home to the Russia investigation. I think he may have thought that by firing FBI Director James Comey that would alleviate some of the pressure on him, but it seems like it's only made it worse. Is that your view?
I absolutely think that firing Comey has increased the pressure on the White House. It has made the president look guilty, whether he is or not. And he's also demonstrating a lack of understanding of the rule of law, specifically the law around obstruction of justice. Just to give you one example, after he fired Comey, for 2 days, the White House message was the firing had nothing to do with the Russia investigation, because the people doing the spinning knew that to say that it was about the Russia investigation would be to implicate the president in obstruction of justice. And the president went on TV with Lester Holt and said, yeah, it was about the investigation of Russia, and tweeted similar things. So again, as with foreign policy, the president is making this worse for himself.
Do you believe that the Western alliance is in jeopardy?
I don't think we're at that stage yet. There has been no open breach. What we have is a bad NATO summit. I can't recall one that went this badly for the United States. That said, we're still in NATO. We still have a very good Secretary of Defense. The national security team around President Trump is mostly made up of responsible people. And I can't imagine McMaster and Mattis and others blithely agreeing to greatly damage the Western alliance. But the fact that we have to have this conversation should be troubling to every person who roots for the Western alliance. And the fact that we're having this conversation shows how great was the success of Putin's interference in our election. Because if it's true that Russia intervened and somehow affected a very close election in Trump's favor, Russia is reaping a harvest right now. For the amount of money they put into it is an amazing windfall. The core goal of first the Soviet Union and then the Russian Federation under Putin has always been to disrupt NATO, to weaken the American commitment to Europe, and to weaken the European Union. And so far, Trump is doing everything Putin could have wanted.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. That's Jeremy Mayer, associate professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. By the way, President Trump has rejected allegations of collusion and dismissed the U.S. intelligence community's assessment that Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign aimed at disrupting the November election and helping Trump win. Meanwhile, the president will announce his decision later today on whether to pull the United States out of the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The president has questioned man's impact on the climate and has insisted withdrawal will save jobs. White House spokesman Sean Spicer telling reporters that the president has been consulting with U.S. business leaders and foreign heads of state, but didn't let on as to whether a decision has been made.
I think the president's comments on this, that he'll be making a decision in the next few days, stand.
Multiple news agencies reported Wednesday that the president already has decided to withdraw from the Global Pact, which has been endorsed by 195 countries. Such a move would be a major reversal of Obama-era policies, pleasing his Republican base but infuriating environmentalists and American allies. Joining me now to talk more about this is global climate policy expert for the Sierra Club, Steve Herz. Steve, probably pretty obvious, but what's your position on the possibility of the U.S. pulling out of this agreement?
Well, it would be a historic mistake for the United States, but one thing that's important to keep in mind is that the Paris Agreement will continue. There's a huge amount of political commitment in other countries, both among their leaders and among citizens, and that commitment is broadly shared among countries of the world. So the Paris Agreement will continue. And countries will meet their commitments under the agreement.
The argument for pulling out of this agreement is that it's a job killer. What say you?
Well, that's obviously mistaken. I mean, we've seen numerous companies come out strongly in favor of the agreement, including companies like even Exxon, Google, Walmart, Microsoft. A number of companies have said, look, this is in our economic interest to continue with the agreement. So it's a very narrow band of fossil fuel interests that want to see the U.S. pull out. But the broad swath of the private sector, broad swath of corporate America actually wants the U.S. to continue.
What are some of the ramifications of pulling out of this agreement?
Big ramification that I see internationally is that if the Trump administration were to isolate the U.S. from the rest of the world in terms of a commitment to attack the climate crisis, there'll be pretty significant diplomatic consequences. So climate change is now seen as a core national interest and a top-tier diplomatic priority by a lot of countries. And if we stand up and say, we're not going to help you with those issues anymore, they're going to be much less likely to cooperate with us on issues that we may prioritize. It's going to make us into a diplomatic pariah, frankly, and it's going to make it very difficult for the Trump administration to gain cooperation. It's also going to hurt our credibility and standing in the world. There's an assumption that great nations fulfill their promises, and by by walking away from that, it's going to make it difficult for other countries to take our word on other issues where we enter into agreements. So it's going to make the U.S. seem like an unreliable partner.
And what about the environmental aspect of all of this, which is really at the heart of what this agreement is all about?
Obviously, we could reduce our emissions much faster if the federal government were fully engaged in the fight. I think there's two things to note here, though. The first is that other countries will continue to take action. And if anything, we're seeing that other countries are realizing that they can do more than they actually committed to in the Paris Agreement. So, for example, since the new year, India has said that they're going to try and end the sale of cars with internal combustion engines by 2030 and go all electric. China has said that they're going to invest $360 billion through 2020 on renewable energy. And those are commitments like outside of the Paris Agreement. There's just things that they realize are in their national interest to do and they can achieve. And so action on climate is accelerating, and that's not going to change regardless of what Trump does. The other thing to keep in mind is domestically, states and cities are moving forward really fast, and the private sector is moving forward really fast. For example, over the last 5 years or so, 250 coal plants have either retired or announced that they will retire by a date certain. And that's not because of President Obama's commitment to climate action. It's because of the way the market trends are going, and market forces are making those coal plants increasingly uncompetitive and too expensive to run.
The president, it would seem, if he does pull out, it would be because he has repeatedly dismissed human-caused climate change. He's called it a hoax invented by the Chinese. And he's also said that U.S. coal, oil, and manufacturing companies are disadvantaged by the efforts to reduce carbon emissions. What do you say to those things?
There's obviously an enormous body of scientific work that supports the reality of a changing climate. And like I said, the main thing that's disadvantaging coal and oil is not the President Obama's efforts to rein in emissions. It's market trends towards renewables and towards improved efficiency. So if you look again over the last 5 to 7 years, we've seen something really interesting in the emissions trends in the U.S. Economic growth has continued apace while emissions are declining. And so the argument that we can only grow our economy while emissions are growing as well may have once been true, but it's clearly no longer true. Those two things, emissions and economic growth, are no longer directly correlated.
All right. Global climate policy expert for the Sierra Club, Steve Herz. 22 Republican senators have issued a letter last week urging President Trump to make a clean break from the Paris Agreement. The letter argued that remaining in it would subject the United States to significant litigation risk that could complicate Trump's effort to overturn Obama-era regulations known as the Clean Power Plan. Here are some of the stories that we are following at voanews.com. A deadly truck bomb rocks Kabul. Donald Trump hails the signing of deals worth billions with Vietnam. Activists seek Trump's help in freeing labor investigators in China. And two documentaries tell different stories about the refugee issue. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, turning now to the latest on what's trending on social media, we are joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Hi, Andrew. So with all this serious news out there, you got anything fun happening on social media?
I do.
Yay.
I have something good. Something that over the past 24 hours has been all over social media. And it was about 24 hours ago, almost to the minute, that we learned of the word covfefe. Now, this was, of course, from President Trump's tweet about constant negative press, covfefe or covfefe. Still not entirely sure how it's pronounced, but ever since President Trump tweeted that just after midnight on Wednesday morning, East Coast time. It has gone all over the internet. It has been the butt of jokes. It has become memes.
Do you think it was a typo?
That's the speculation, or was speculation at least until earlier today when White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said that it was not a typo. He said that the president and a small group of people know exactly what he meant. So maybe it was an acronym, maybe it's an inside joke.
Who knows?
But it has captured attention all over the internet. Absolutely, it has gone viral. And some people say to the detriment of other bigger news stories, particularly the news about the Paris Accord, people saying that people are focused more on this trivial story than they are on something more serious. But lots of interest in this, lots of jokes at Trump's expense. People saying, though, he showed a bit of humor when he tweeted out and asked people to guess what this means. He said, can you figure out what it means? Enjoy. So some sense of humor
there.
It has been an interesting 24 hours. If you would have asked me yesterday if we'd be talking about Covfefe, I would have said, what? Exactly is that, and we still don't know what it is. So
okay.
we will see.
Well, good. It's nice to be able to laugh about something.
It is.
Anything else going on?
Yes. Yeah, so less funny story, but a very interesting one with some big implications for social media. A Swiss court has fined a man more than $4,000 for liking a defamatory post on Facebook. So this man had liked several posts written about a man, an animal rights activist, accusing him of anti-Semitism and fascism. He liked these posts over a period of time, and the court found that was defamation. So they are fining him. His lawyer said they're going to fight this. But the interesting implication about this is, what does this mean for free speech? Now, this is a very limited case in Switzerland, but something like this in, say, the United States, where we have First Amendment free speech rights, not sure if you could hold that up in a court and say that's defamation. But this is something that's come up time and time again on social media. Are posts that people put out defamation? We talked about the Facebook files a couple weeks ago. Certain things you say are not allowed. Certain things you say that you don't think would be allowed are allowed. So it's a very gray area, not the fine line that we would expect it to be. And this is certainly one of those cases where you can say things and get in trouble for them, even though they seem innocuous.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. By the way, you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, the U.S. space agency NASA announced Wednesday that it'll launch a mission next year to send a spacecraft directly into the sun's atmosphere. It was made during a ceremony to honor astrophysicist Eugene Parker, for whom the Parker Solar Probe is named. Scientists say they'll gather data on solar activity and give a better idea of how space weather events can impact life on Earth. It'll orbit about 8 times closer to the sun than any spacecraft has ever flown. It will need to withstand heat and radiation no human could endure.
We want to go down there, take the challenge of going in the worst kind of thermal environment in the solar system, survive that because we built the machines robust enough to do that, measure the environment there and really prove and find what the kind of heating processes really are.
The probe is on track to be launched during the 20-day window beginning June 31st, 2018. Joining me now to talk more about it, NASA Jet Propulsion Ambassador Greg Redfern. Greg, tell us more about this hot mission.
NASA had on the books a mission that they were calling the Solar Probe, but they renamed it for Dr. Eugene Parker, who in 1958 proposed a theory that eventually became known as the solar wind. We have space weather out there in the solar system. We have storms, we have wind from the sun, and it affects our planet, it affects spacecraft, satellites, planets, and Dr. Parker was very instrumental in coming up with this theory. And you are so right about this being a hot mission, because at its closest, it is going to be 3.9 million miles above the gaseous surface of the sun, and it's going to be exposed to 2,500 degree Fahrenheit temperatures. And this baby's going to cook, because at closest approach, it's going to be traveling 430,000 miles an hour.
Wow, that's fascinating. So what are they hoping to find out by doing this?
There has been a mystery since Dr. Parker and other scientists who work on the sun have been exploring our star. Now, our sun is a star, just like the stars we see in the nighttime sky. So you could say that this is NASA's closest mission to a star. And what we want to try and find out is, what is it that causes this phenomenon we call the corona, or the sun's outer atmosphere, to be at 1 million degrees Fahrenheit when the surface temperature of the sun is only 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit? It's been a mystery for 60 years. So we are going to fly through this corona, this outer atmosphere, and this instrument package is going to sample and measure and really give us our first ever up-close and personal view of a star, also happens to be our star, the sun. Very exciting stuff.
Sure, it's going to be hot up there.
It will be, but you know what, Laurie? This is groundbreaking technology, because the spacecraft is going to be protected by a 4.5-inch layer of carbon composite material, and the instruments are going to end up working at room temperature. Imagine that. You're flying through 15-degree temperature, but it's only room temperature where we are here working with the instruments.
All right, well, sounds fascinating. Thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on this. That's NASA Jet Propulsion Ambassador Greg Redfern. And turning now to the entertainment world, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. So, hey, Nicole, singer Olivia Newton-John having a sad turn of events regarding her health. What's the latest?
She had previously announced that she had to postpone some of her upcoming tour dates because she was suffering from severe back pain. But just this week, she came out and said that she had been to the doctor and her severe back pain was actually a previous diagnosis of breast cancer that has moved into her back. She's now has to cancel all of her upcoming June U.S. and Canada tour dates. And she previously battled this cancer in 1992. So now we're talking like 15 years and it's back. So it's really sad for her. But she assured fans that she's working with her doctors and she plans to undergo radiation treatments as well as try some natural remedies and really take this time to rest and recover. So I know a lot of her fans are sending her thoughts and good get well soon messages. So hopefully she'll be back on the road before we know it.
We wish her all the best, of course. And then we've got George Clooney. He and his wife, Amal, are very close to having babies.
Yes, they are due in June. We don't have an exact public due date. No public due date has been announced for the Clooney twins, but he did have to miss an award show he was supposed to be in Armenia this week, but he sent a nice video message and joked that while he would have loved to be at the award show that night, he's pretty sure that if his wife gave birth to those twins while he was out of the country, she would not let him back home in their house. So it's good that he stayed behind with her. And it sounds like he's really, really excited. We do know that they are having a boy and a girl. George's mom was really excited after they announced they were expecting and accidentally spilled the beans in an interview in February. So that's really great for them. And he's been joking about what he wants to name those babies. He said in a red carpet interview that he wants to name them Casa and Amigos, which is after the tequila brand that he owns with Cindy Crawford's husband, Randy Gerber. Mm-hmm. But he said Amal shot that one down. So it doesn't sound like we're going to have Casa and Amigos Clooney, but it will be exciting to see what they name the babies and to see what the babies look like, because I'm sure they're going to inherit both their parents' beautiful genes. So it's all exciting for George and them all.
All right. Rare.us content editor Nicole Michelle.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study concerning string theory was recently released by mechanical engineers at the University of California, Berkeley. Before you think this concerns a quantum or particle physics hypothesis, this study concerns shoestrings, specifically why our shoelaces manage to keep getting untied. They found out that the failure of a shoelace knot takes place in just a few seconds and is set off by a series of complex force reactions that act like an invisible hand. These forces loosen the knot and then tug on the free ends of the laces until they become undone. While tying shoelaces as tightly as possible will still result in the knot becoming untied eventually, doing so at least will give you more time before you have to stop and retie your shoes compared to laces tied loosely. I give my shoelaces a double bow to keep them secure. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Roy Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction in any country of any individual who committed, conspired to commit, or aided or abetted in the commission of the murder of U.S. citizen Joel Shrum. On March 18, 2012, Shrum, 29, was shot and killed on his way to work in Taiz, Yemen, by a gunman riding on the back of a motorcycle that had pulled up alongside his vehicle. At the time of his death, Shrum was an administrator and English teacher at the International Training and Development Center, one of the longest-standing international development organizations in Yemen. A few days after the attack, the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula claimed responsibility for the murder. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. You can follow Rewards for Justice on Twitter, @rewards_justice. More information about the Shrum Reward offer is located on the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net. Anyone with information on this case can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.